Parshas Yisro. Here we go. Atav Shanayin Gimel. We are focusing on the Pasuk Aleph of Perek Chaf. A very straightforward pasuk. The kind of pasuk we've seen a gazillion times in the Torah. Okay? Ve'edabra elokim eskol hadvarim ha'ela lemor. Okay? So God spoke all these things, saying. Now, the next pasukim, as you can see, are the Aseres HaDibros. So this is the introductory pasuk to the Aseres HaDibros. And we spoke a lot here, and it's not our subject today, of the usage of the term Dibur for conveying the Aseres HaDibros. Okay? But we also find in this pasuk the word Amira, Vayidaber Elokim Eskol Hadvarim Ha'ela Lemor. And that has, that word, Lemor, forces us to ask a whole bunch of questions. First of all, normally, when the Torah says, Vaydabra Elokim, or Dabra Hashem El Moshe Lemor, it means God spoke to Moshe and told him to say to Klal Yisrael. That's when you find the two words together. Vaydabra Elokim El Moshe Lemor. Hashem spoke to Moshe that he should say. Okay? That it was about the purpose of Hashem speaking was that Moshe's to convey to Klal Yisrael. However, that can't possibly be what Lemor means in this pasuk because HaKadosh Baruch Hu is speaking to Klal Yisrael. Klal Yisrael are hearing the Aseres HaDibros with Moshe. Now, if they heard all of the Aseres HaDibros with the same degree of clarity or apprehension that Moshe heard them, this is a big debate, of course. We say that they heard the first two, Mipi HaGevura and the others, more directly from Moshe. Regarding those first two, Anochi Hashem Elokecha and Lo Yelecha, what they perceived, what they apprehended, was it to the degree similar to how Moshe apprehended? Were they raised up to that level? Did they apprehend at a lesser level? We know that we are told that all of the Dibros came at them in one moment. All the Dibros were said as one single Dibra, which was too much for them to absorb, and Moshe had to go back and reiterate to them what the details of what they heard were. But there's no question that they are experiencing the direct communication of the Kodesh Baruch Hu. So what's the Lemor? So Rashi has, and second of all, the other question is, where's the aspect of Amira? Amira, remember what we said about Amira? Amira is the Lashon Raka, it's soft. It means my will is knowable, and there's some type of leeway left for people to choose to connect to it or to choose to ignore it. Whereas Vayedaber is, I demand that you respond to me. There's it's too clear, it's too compelling, it's too forceful, it leaves no room for the person to escape the obligations that it brings. And Amira is more of allows for some type of choice on this part of the other. So what's the Amira here in the Dibros? Okay? So Rashi has an explanation of why there's this word Lemor. And, often, we have a problem with the Rashi, because Rashi's designated task is to make the Torah readable, to make it flow. So he always tries to stick with the pshat and what's going on in the story and give us explanations that work with what's going on at this time. So that's number one. We have to see that's what Rashi's doing. But Rashi's explanation seems to come out of absolutely nowhere. So look in the Rashi. What does the word lemor mean? Vaydabar Elokim eskol hadvarim ha'ela lemor. So Rashi says on that, lemor milame, this teaches us, shahayu onin al hein hein va'al lav lav, that they would actually respond, yes, to the mitzvahs aseh, and what Hashem said do, they said yes, we will do, and what Hashem said don't do, they said no, we won't do. How is that lemor? Now, unless you want to really stretch the pshat and try to say that Rashi's saying that Bnei Yisroel were saying something, that Vidabra Elokim is Advar Me'ela, that that's referring to Hashem, and then lemor is referring to Klal Yisrael, that they're saying something, but that's hard. And you want to say that HaKadosh Baruch Hu spoke to tell Moshe to reiterate to them, and on Moshe's reiteration, they responded, hein, hein, lav, lav, yes to the yeses, no to the noes. But why does Rashi even need to tell us here that Bnei Yisrael are responding. And what is this response of Klal Yisrael anyway? And what's very interesting here, taking it further, right? And why did Klal Yisrael have to kind of what, rubber stamp it? Yes, okay, Mitzvah Zaseh, yes. Mitzvah Lo Zaseh, no. Is a rubber stamp? I mean, what is Klal Yisrael saying here? What is Rashi telling us? And how does it fit into the pshat? And what's even more interesting is that Rashi draws this pshat down from a mechilta, okay? And the mechilta has another opinion that Rashi does not choose to use, okay? The mechilta brings down two opinions. One is the opinion of Rabbi Yishmael, which Rashi uses, hein hein lav lav, but there is another opinion. There is an opinion of Rabbi Akiva, and Rabbi Akiva does not agree with Rabbi Yishmael, and Rabbi Akiva says, when they heard Hashem say, Mitzvah Aseh, they said, Hein. Yes, agreed. We will. When Hashem said, a Mitzvah Lo Saseh, they said, Hein. Yes, agreed. That's Rabbi Akiva. Now, what's the difference? What's the machlokas? Why is Rabbi Akiva saying that? Why does Rashi only pick Rabbi Yishmael's, the other one? And the halacha is, by the way, that in general, this is the standard running halacha is, that halacha k'Rabbi Akiva mechavera. Whenever there's a argument, it's always according to Rabbi Akiva. Why is Rashi going with Rabbi Yishmael? Okay, so let's first try to understand the machlokas between Rabbi Yishmael and Rabbi Akiva. Okay, the Maharal explains it. Rabbi Yashaber like to speak about it. And the machlokas of Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Yishmael can be understood within the context of two different, not only eras in Jewish history, but ways of experiencing, ways of becoming in line with the will of Hashem. One was more conducive, more natural to the Har Sinai moment, and one was more natural to Rabbi Akiva's milieu, and Rabbi Akiva, of course, has to be understood as being the Moshe Rabbeinu of Torah Shebal Peh. Right, Rabbi Akiva is the Moshe Rabbeinu of Torah Shebal Peh. So what Rabbi Akiva is saying is coming from that perspective, from who he is and the role he plays. And Rabbi Yishmael is coming from the perspective, and Rashi is using him, of what is from the perspective of not Torah Shebal Peh, but Mamad Har Sinai, which is Torah Shebichsav, and the revelation of it, the prophetic revelation of it. The difference between Torah Shebichsav and Torah Shebal Peh is that Torah Shebichsav was apprehended by, also, portion of their apprehension was definitely Nevuah. We spoke about last year, I think it was, or maybe the year before, that the whole idea of them sleeping in the Machane and Moshe waking them up and standing them up, remember we said that? That they believed that their total experience of revelation would be in a prophetic state. And Moshe made it clear that they had to stand and be awake. In other words, that there was an aspect of learning Torah rationally that was also taking place. It wasn't only a prophetic experience. But there's no question that what there was a prophetic experience of the highest order at Har Sinai. Okay? And that's what Rashi wants you to know, that if that's what's going on, under those circumstances, what Rabbi Shmuel is talking about is that the natural response is hein, hein, lav, lav. But under, in the circumstances, we're talking about Rabbi Akiva, and Torah Shebal Peh, and where the Chacham replaces the Navi, where our rational thought and our logic and our analysis replaces revelation, then the proper response is Al Hein Hein Va'alav Hein. So what does that mean? In the course of revelation, what happens is it becomes self-evident. It becomes known that everything in this material universe is an expression of the will of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Every single aspect of existence, the physical universe, the every part of nature, including human nature, including our emotions and our intellect and our and what we think about and what we want and what we need, it's all an expression of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And when that is opened up, this is what we mean when we say the mountain over their heads. Same type of idea, Har Kegigas. What that means is that when Klal Yisrael had a revelation, they were able to perceive and experience from the point of view, so to speak, of HaKadosh Baruch Hu himself, So that what Hashem said is necessary. It's a mitzvah aseh, something to do and to invest in. They said, yes, of course, that's obvious. When Hashem said, this is forbidden, it doesn't, it's not, it's contradictory to the metzias. It's, metzias, you know that word. It's the reality of all things. This is a false reality. You imagine that there's reality to this because it seems real to you, because you need it, or you feel like it's pleasurable, or it makes you feel good, or makes you feel established and secure, or gives you an identity. It's all fantasy. It's all false. There's no reality to it all. So it's a lo sase. And they said, yes, that's evident. It's evident. Hein hein lav lav means it's self-evident. What you say is yes. That's the way we see it too. What you say is no, that's the way we see it. It's no. Completely a way of perception that is so clear, so aligned with truth, that it's naturally, viscerally, the person's own impression is the same of HaKadosh Baruch Hu's. The person's own reaction is the same as HaKadosh Baruch Hu's. There's no resistance. This sounds a lot like what we speak about in Bereishis, right? When the human being is not yet, you know, unfortunately tainted to whatever degree we choose by our own insistence on our own interpretation, our subjectivity, and we see things clearly, and nothing gets confused, you know, in its path from up there to us. And then we say, hein, hein, lav, lav. And since this is Matan Torah, and Klal Yisrael having this type of clear vision, Rashi brings down Rabbi Shmuel that says, hein, hein, lav, lav. But Rabbi Akiva is talking about it, is in a different era. He's the beginning of Torah Shebal Peh. I mean, he's not the beginning. Torah Shebal Peh originates at Sinai. But with Rabbi Akiva starts that all of Torah from that point on is a product of human effort. In other words, application of principles, keeping the events of Har Sinai alive by establishing, by determining what today's situation is in light of the principles established at Har Sinai. It's the human effort. It's rationalization. It's not coming to at something that we might not necessarily understand intuitively to be the truth, and arriving at the conclusion that this is an extension of the halachas given at Sinai. Therefore, it's the truth, although it makes no rational sense why this matters. All right? If the 39 avos melachos, right, if keeping Shabbos has certain principles, and that comes down to today, not squeezing a sponge, it might not mean anything to me or seem in you know, like self-evidently clear that that's in violation of Shabbos, okay? But logical process, working off what the malachas are and their you know, the ramifications, leads us to this conclusion that this is forbidden. So that's what it is, and we accept it. Rabbi Akiva is saying, alav hein. That's me, that's obedience. You say no, I accept. It's not lav lav. You say no, I know it's no. It's self-evident to me that it's no. Rabbi Akiva is saying in the time period of rational thinking, we impose upon ourselves truths, that's called obedience, acquiescence, surrender. If our logic, if our analysis tells us that this is how the halacha plays itself out, or what Hashem, you know, what we're supposed to be doing in terms of what Midas Hashem demands from us, then that's what it is, and we accept it, and we say, yes, we'll do that too. Yes, we'll avoid that. It's a whole different relationship. It's one that takes much more effort and self-control, and it is not a lazy effort that things are natural and intuitive. It's one of work, and it's one where the chacham comes into play. It's not given by nevuah. And that Rabbi and Rashi doesn't bring that explanation because that's not what Har Sinai was about. Although Rabbi Akiva, we always pass on Rabbi Akiva, that is the reality for the entire era of Jewish history, post the Nevuah era. Now, regarding, let's first talk about their experience at Har Sinai, and then we'll talk about Rabbi Akiva, more our reality. Their experience at Har Sinai was one of apprehension of the reality that everything is clearly a continuation of HaKadosh Baruch Hu's will, and that will is understood to be perfect and good. And it's clear, this is all things we don't have a full grasp on. And everything that is conducive to it is and attached to it is reality. And everything that is a fantasy of our own making is not reality and shouldn't come into play at all. Now, their revelation is described you know, as being petachtis ahar, underneath the mountain. Rashi says Hashem picked up the mountain like a barrel, said, if you accept the Torah, good. If not, here is your, there will be your graves. Now, it doesn't have to be taken literally. It means their experience, their revelation, what they saw was so compelling, there were no options anymore. Further beyond this, we have in Parshas Mishpatim, which comes a little later, that Moshe and Aaron and 70 Zakenim got an additional glimpse of this reality. And Rambam talks about it. It's a very strange pasuk. We're going to mention it now instead of next week's Parsha, but it says that they saw Hashem, and tachas raglo, under his feet, was, as it were, the working of a sapphire brick that was white. Okay? Now, you know we're talking about some prophetic revelation here. So Rambam, in the Mor Nevuchim, in the first section, in chapter 28, starts to explain all this. And the point here is he wants to say that whiteness doesn't mean white. It means transparent. And he describes it like a crystal, for the whiteness of a crystal is not due to a white color, but solely to its transparency. And it says if it were a color, it would not let all the colors be seen behind it, and it would not receive them all. So imagine a prism. We don't see white light normally, but when you hold up a prism, you see all the other colors in a spectrum are diffracting. They all come from the white light. They're all in the white light. Okay? Now, this is getting into an area which physics today is grappling with, okay? All things that exist in the material world have their origin, we know today, it's one of the basic ideas, in energy, a non-physical reality. There are even other theories that claim that you don't even need that original energy to produce matter. You know, the E equals MC squared of Einstein. He's like the Rabbi Akiva Lahavdil of physics. Explain that energy is mass, and mass is the quantification of matter. In other words, energy becomes matter, and matter becomes eventually sentient thinking, and then we get into the whole Jewish idea of Sof Maaseh B'Machshav Tchila, the end cause is the original purpose. One of the main points is that it's energy that leads to matter, and energy has, they're grappling with this idea, a beginning, we say. Maybe that's Yehi Ar. Ar is energy. But there's something before Yehi Ar. There's something before this explosion of energy. There's something that pre-existed or caused it. Talking about cause itself brings in an entire problem, because cause and effect are time-bound, and time was created. So when we speak about the cause of something, we're already confused, because that means the beginning and that means time. And when we speak about things that start at a certain point, at a certain time, we're limiting ourselves. What about the time is created at that point too? So what is beyond that? You can't even say before it, but beyond that. One of the very good books, but you have to know a little bit about physics, is this. Paul Davies, God and the New Physics. It was like 10 years old or maybe a little more. Very good explanation of what's going on. I would always be doubtful of reading. I'd be careful reading like a Kirov physicist that has an agenda, which is to select from what's going on in physics in order to prove a point that they believe anyway, which is our version. But going through all the this is, you know, a non-affiliated physicist, and going through the different places that physics is going towards and working with, it's still nothing, it ends up in contradiction to what we're saying, because it all comes down to something that started everything. Okay. Now, it says that they were able to perceive. Rambam, this is getting into ideas that have their concretization in the Ikrim of what we have to believe. But Rambam talks about a primordial, original, prime source of matter, let's say, the source of all things. And he says that they got a glimpse here of how everything came from that, from some, even that original, what he calls golem, by the way, comes from an original primary source. And they got a glimpse of how that all, you know, found its way into the world we know today. Now, you might want to say it like this. Talking about the Big Bang, okay? We know that even if you want to say it released energy, and then energy eventually became matter, okay? And matter eventually became the galaxies, and galaxies eventually became, you know, the organic, all the various components. And but even that moment before, you know, we don't have to say before, sorry, that cause of, all these are hard words, that led to the explosion of everything that led to everything, okay, is still their vision. He wants to say, is that vision, and it's still too limited. He actually says it's an incorrect, it's not a full vision. And the reason he says it's not a full vision and it's incorrect and it keeps God too associated with things that exist in this world is because after they perceived it, the pasuk says they ate and they drank. So, to make a long story short, his Klal Yisrael got some type of vision, and Moshe and Aaron and the Shivim Zakenim got a vision. How everything is an expression of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, but even they did not get the total vision of its total separation from the material, because everything we know, from the point we know anything and onwards, it's within the material. Being very, very careful, philosophers are incredibly careful to avoid the trap of, like, Spinoza, of pantheism, that everything we see and all the forces at play and all the laws of physics are the totality, or they are, so to speak, God's existence. This is, there's, we go even beyond that. This is all, this HaKadosh Baruch was prior. They were able to see from a certain point onwards, not even everything, but from that point onwards, they were sure, from seeing from that beginning point and onward, that made them sure enough, absolutely sure, that everything is an expression of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. We might say today, everything is energy. If we could release the energy in the matter, right? We have an explosion, we have a nuclear explosion. It's all energy. Now we're also, energy is everywhere. Energy is in every form. So they saw that. They saw this in a spiritual way. Everything that exists is a Kadosh Baruch Hu's will, is from the same source, is obviously various expressions of the same thing. And they were able to see that in terms of the mitzvahs ase and the mitzvahs los ase. Okay? Now, we said that this is all in the realm of nevuah. Revelation that was a once-in-a-lifetime experience that we don't normally get to see. Physics still is grappling, coming, working with these ideas, trying to get an understanding of it, and coming closer and closer, it seems. Now, on a physical level, Rabbi Akiva says something else. Rabbi Akiva says, we said, hein and lav hein. Rabbi Akiva says things we don't understand, things that make no sense, even mishpatim, even civil law, even things that seem rational, have at a certain point an irrational element to them. For example, you can't kill. What about, you know, a horrible, miserable, evil human being that's so detrimental there, whatever, all their choices and everything, that all their underhanded, you know, games that hurt and harm other people. Can you go kill them? They're not killing people. They're just stealing from them. They're just taking away their opportunities. They're just undermining them. Nevertheless, there's lo tirtzach, right? There are certain things, even reasonable things, that at a certain point break down. They hit a brick wall, and we say, Allah, hein, fine, we won't kill. We want to, it seems reasonable to. Euthanasia, there's a million different things. The law is you're not allowed to kill. That's the rational aspect, that's the part that has to be, that we surrender ourselves to. Now, the question is this. We have an idea that there's a machlokas between the philosopher, so to speak, and our thinkers, our chazal, and they say, how do you approach things that you want to do, that you have an urge to do, but like Rabbi Akiva, we say, Allah, hey, and fine. You say it's no, yes, then I won't do it. I accept that. Not that I know intuitively that it's wrong. I really think it's great. I'd love to indulge in it. But Hashem said no. So you know what this famous thing is, right? A person, the Gemara says, a person shouldn't say, I would never want to wear shatnez. I would never want to eat not kosher. I would never want to marry someone that the Torah forbids me from marrying. Of course, rather the Gemara says, a person doesn't have to say that. That doesn't mean a person's on a higher level. A person should say, of course I would love to do these things, but I'm stuck. Hashem said no. So which one is on a higher madrega? Knowing intuitively that something is, I would never be, this has no appeal to me. I see it self-evident that it's contrary to Hashem's will, so I have no interest in it. Or saying, of course I would, but I can't. Which one's on a higher madrega? So everybody should have a copy of, at least, you know, not the whole entire works of the Rambam, but in English we have these, the little portions of the Rambam's major work, and this is called the Shmone Prakim, the 8 chapters. A fun, required reading. So chapter 6, we really kind of need to read this whole thing, but it's only to a couple of pages. So let me read this to you. Philosophers maintain that a person who controls his base instincts is someone who inwardly craves the immoral, even though he may perform many commendable acts. He overcomes his passion by actively grappling with the urges stirred by his emotions, desires, and natural inclination. But even while he is acting in a moral fashion, he is being tormented by his inner conflict. A saintly man, however, is guided in his actions by his innate disposition to do good. His urgings and desires are to do good things. Philosophers unanimously agree that a saintly man is better and more perfect than a person who has to curb his passions, although the two are equal in many things. In general, a person who has to subdue his cravings must necessarily be rated lower than a saintly man, because the desire to do evil lurks in his heart. And although he does not actually do evil, his fondness for evil indicates that his soul is flawed. Philosophers, he doesn't mean Jewish philosophers, okay? Other philosophers. King Solomon expressed a similar idea when he said in Proverbs and Mishlei, the soul of the wicked desires evil. Speaking of the joy a saintly man experiences when he is doing good and the torment felt by one who acts virtuously but is not innately righteous, King Solomon says, it is a joy to the righteous to do justice, but a torment to the evildoer. The sayings of Tanakh here accord with the tenets of the philosophers. So he just said that they're right. Now, next. In studying the works of the rabbis on this subject, we find that they value the person who controls his impulse to sin more than one who has no urge to sin. Sounds like a contradiction. And therefore does not struggle to refrain from evil. That sounds like Rashi's Rabbi Shmuel's opinion. Okay. They even go so far as to say that the more praiseworthy and perfect a man is, the greater is his desire to transgress, the stronger his turmoil when he controls his urge to sin. The greater the man, the stronger his evil inclination. You know that one, right? God, kol ha-gadol mechavero, yitzro gadol mimenu. And if this were not enough, they add that the reward of the person who overcomes his evil inclination is commensurate with the anguish he suffers because of his resistance. In the words of the rabbis, the reward is in proportion to the suffering. What's that in Hebrew? Good. Lefum tzara agra. Even further, they command you to acknowledge your desire and your need to conquer it, forbidding you to say, even if the Torah did not prohibit it, my nature is such that I have no desire to commit such and such a transgression. Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel put it like this. You should not say, I do not desire to eat meat and milk together. I do not desire to wear clothes made of wool and linen. I do not desire to enter into a forbidden marriage. But you should say, yes, I do indeed desire to perform these acts, but my hands are tied, for my Father in heaven has forbidden it. So which is right? Or which, right? Let me think about that. If we compare the sayings of the philosophers with those of the rabbis, they might seem to contradict each other. However, this is not so. Not only are both correct, there is not the slightest disagreement between them. When the philosophers describe a person who has no longing for evil as superior to one who desires evil but conquers his passions, the evils they speak of are those that all commonly agree are immoral, such as murder, theft, robbery, fraud, causing injury to one who has done no harm, repaying benevolence with malice, contempt for parents, and the like. Okay? In other words, then when they say a person who wants to do these things is on a lower level than a person who doesn't, they're saying a kind of person who's drawn to this, who gets pleasure from this, is on a lower level than a person who doesn't. Of these commandments, the rabbi said, if they had not already been written in the Torah, it would have been proper to include them. In other words, they're self-evident. They're basic moral assumptions, and without them, a person who doesn't have these things has a moral flaw. Some of our later sages who were infected with the erroneous theories of the Mutakalimun, that's these Arab philosophers, these Muslim philosophers that he always tried to show were off base, they called these type of things rational commandments. But he says like this. Okay, we're not going to go into that little point. But clearly, that's a technical thing. Clearly, a soul that lusts to perform these misdeeds is flawed. A noble soul has absolutely no desire to commit any of these crimes and is not disturbed in abstaining from them. However, when the rabbis praise one who overcomes his desire as more worthy and entitled to a greater reward than one who has no such battle, they are only referring to revealed laws. Revealed, things you wouldn't have come up with on your own. Chukim. Things that are not in the category of morality and ethics and decency.
A forbidden marriage falls into that?
Yeah, a forbidden marriage. You're not allowed to marry, you know, a mother and her daughter or something. I mean, it's a chok. I'm not talking about eishes ish. That's a moral law. Adultery, stealing someone else's wife, is a moral flaw. It's geneva, right, too. But we're not talking about that. It's just certain people are forbidden to be married. A Kohen can marry a Grusha or whatever, okay? Okay, these are revealed laws. In other words, shatness, chalav, basar v'chalav, okay? These are revealed laws. When Hashem revealed the Torah to Klal Yisrael on Har Sinai, it was self-evident that what was not kosher was not to be, you know, that there would be no desire for it, or that nobody would wear wool and linen together. This became self-evident because they saw the whole thing. They got a glimpse into everything in this world and its nature and its direct connection to its source, and understood its teva, and if putting and using it in this way is with reality or out of reality, they understood.
So did the vision change them?
It was, we have lost the capacity. Yes, this is a nevuah that we don't think like this. We don't have this openness. It's correct. We're in Rabbi Akiva's mode. So this is so because if it were not for the Torah, these would not be considered transgressions at all. Therefore, the rabbis say that you should allow your soul to yearn for them, knowing that the Torah alone restrains you from these actions. Because unless you have revelation, you don't know why these things are out of bounds. Consider the wisdom of the sages. They did not say this. One should not say, I have no desire to kill, I have no desire to steal, and to lie. Rather say, I have a desire for these things, but what can I do? My Father in heaven forbids it. That's not what they said. The examples they do cite are all from the mitzvah, what he calls shimios, the revealed commandments, such as eating meat and milk together, wearing clothes made of shatness, entering into forbidden marriages. These and similar commandments are what the Torah calls chukim. Okay? Chok teva, the laws of nature, also chukim. They're engraved in nature. There are certain rules that doesn't matter whether you relate to them or respond to them emotionally or you understand them. Gravity is a fact. Electromagnetivity is a fact, right? The way protons and neutrons behave is a fact. So it doesn't matter whether you like it or it appeals to you or it makes sense to you. Now, in a state of revelation, we understand these things. In a state of we understand where they come from and how they operate, and if we get to, and we don't want to violate them, we understand how certain things can actually violate basic ingrained rules that are at the core of the existence of this universe. But so that's a factor of revelation. A person, oh no, I would never, you know, wear shatness. That comes from revelation. That's a chok and only understood through nevuah. Okay, but anything that comes that's a moral law, those are things that a person should get to a point where they have no interest in these things and they don't feel pain for abstaining. The rabbis explained that chukim are statutes which I, Hashem, enacted for you and which you have no right to, you know, doubt or criticize or obviously resist if you don't understand them. Chukim are the laws that the nations of the world attack and that Satan condemns. For instance, the statutes of the red cow, the Seir La'azazel, and so forth, okay? From this discussion, you should now understand those transgressions which the more noble person does not covet and the less noble person needs particularly to resist. It should be clear with which transgressions are their opposite. It is astounding that these two discourses are in fact compatible with each other, the philosophers and the rabbis, and the text bears out the truth of our explanation. This ends the discussion of the subject matter of this chapter. All these chapters are so fundamental. So here, that's number one. Let's put that idea to rest. When a person does not have revelation, so things that make no sense to us fall under the category of lav, hein. You said no, hein. That's it. So I accept. Now, next question. Okay. When a person does that work, which puts in the effort to surrender to the will of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, to make a choice, okay, to say, you said lav, then it's hein, I accept that. It doesn't come from me. It's not my way of I don't perceive it to be, you know, outside of reality. Therefore, sheker. Therefore, death. Therefore, ra. but I accept it. Then a person goes against their own way of seeing things, their own intuition, their own gut reactions to things, their own conclusions. That work is the fundamental work of living, period. Here, we ask a basic question. A person says, I. What? Who's the I? Okay, so the first initial assumption is this is my I. The problem is, and this is so beautifully explained in the Gesher HaChayim, okay? This is the third volume, the one that's translated into English. It's a three-volume set, but they translated the third volume into English because it has all kinds of beautiful philosophical ideas, and it is on death and mourning and the soul and what happens to the soul and this world and the next world. And he works with an idea that just the way he says it is so well done. And he works with this idea, and he gives this particular example, which I liked. He said, the fact is that to prove that I am not my body, okay, simply, I can command my hair to grow blonde, can I? What happens if I, okay, put into my mouth, chas v'shalom, something, and I realize it's poison? I cannot command my body to stop metabolizing it. I can't do anything about it. Things happen completely against my will. My body keeps doing what it does when I'm sleeping, and I have absolutely no control over it.
Not to stop.
A person can slow down their heart a little bit. A person can slow down their breathing a little bit. But the body isn't. It's called the autonomic nervous system. We have limited control over it. We don't have full control over it. I do not tell my body exactly what kind of baby it should look. You know what it should look like, and it doesn't listen to me. It does what it does. Now, therefore, when we say I, it can't possibly be my body. I have no control over my body. Now, my body doesn't just mean physically. Thoughts arise. We know we don't have control over all the thoughts that pop into our head. Temptations, desires for things arise that we don't have control of. We see something and there's a desire is there. Okay? So we can't control these things. We have to manage them. We're not the source of them. Now, what about the neshama? Maybe that's the I. Problem. What do we say every single morning? Wait, Elokai, neshama shenasata bi. So who's the bi? The neshama you put in me. So it's not my. I'm not my neshama either. My neshama is not me. So who is the ani? Now philosophers have worked with this. Hillel said, "Im ein ani li mili." We know modern day thinking, right? Great philosophers. Famous ideas, I think, therefore I am. Okay, where is the ani? The only place that the ani exists, okay? The only place that you can identify as being I, the ani, is in my choice to observe all my emotions, all information that's coming in at me from my body and from my neshama and from my learning, which is supposed to enhance and inform me. And my choice, I choose what to think about, what to dwell on, what to work on. I choose which emotions to force to be dominant and put them aside and which to allow to flourish. I choose what to think. I choose what to choose. I choose what to feel. Things come at me and I make a choice of what to reject and what to accept. And that choice, making those choices, is the only place that the ani exists. The totality of that work is I, the I that goes from this world into the next world, the I that lives eternally. When we say, okay, kol Yisrael yesh lem chelek le'olam haba, okay, we do not say kol Yisrael yesh lem chelek bi'olam haba. It's not like there's something called olam haba and there's a little part for me over there. So I'm here and olam haba is there, and in olam haba, bi means in olam haba, I have a little portion. It's kol Yisrael yesh lem chelek le'olam haba means towards, to. What we're saying is a person, the ani, the b'chira chafshis of a person, is creating with each proper choice, okay, a world to live in a non-physical world that we inhabit. And the Ani lives in this world of our own creation that we make of our free choice. Okay? So that's the only place of the Ani. That's where the Ani exists. That's where we are alive. A person who is not engaged in making those choices, who's just reacting to stimuli, cannot be said to be alive at all, to have any identity, to have an Ani beyond their body, which dies, and their neshama, which goes back to Shemayim. So there's nothing else left. What's left? Nothing. Nothing else exists. Shem is Hashem's, and the body goes to the earth, and nothing, and in between there's nothing. So the Ani is the choices, it's all non-physical, it's all machshava, determination, thinking, and those choices then express themselves in what I say, in what I do, in the material world. But the source of all of those material expressions is the work, the choices that take place.
So what's the Yetzer Hara?
So the Yetzer, the word Yetzer, it's a good question. The word Yetzer means liyatzer, to form. Okay, in English we say that everyone has creative energy. Leaving aside the semantics, that in Hebrew the word bria means to create something from nothing, and yetzira means something from something, we're talking about yetzira, creating out of our raw material. And that's what we just said. All kinds of raw material is given to us, our bodies, our emotions, thoughts, it's all coming at us. It's raw material, okay? It's there, we're not the creators of it. Okay. Also coming at us is messages from our neshama. Some are intuitive. Some we're increasing by learning. Okay. And then we choose, say, this idea, where we do this work, where the Ani lives. The Ani is Yotzer, forming something specific out of all of that chaos. Okay. If we form, if we devote our creative, so to speak, formative energy, then we choose to what to love and what to care about, and what to devote ourselves to, and what to want and what to value. We, if we choose correctly, that's called the Yetzer Hatov. We formed something good with our creative energy. If we don't really put in the effort, it's about effort, to make those choices, and we just respond to stimuli, and we then allow all our creative energy to be devoted to how best to satisfy our physical impulses, our emotional impulses, our intellectual impulses, and we let all our energy be drawn in that direction, we formed Ra. Because really what's happened is we formed Ra, which is a non-metzius, a non-reality, a fantasy, a bubble of delusion that we live in, that these things are real, that they have any future for us, that they have any value to them. So the Yetzer Hara, Yetzer Tov are the options. You know, that's the things that are, that what we call the evil inclination or the good inclination. Really, we have to be more careful. We take everything that's coming at us and we choose to incline into one direction or the other. And that choice is the Ani, and that creates my world, and that's the world I live in when this world is over. Okay? And Rabbi Akiva is telling us that when things come at us that are keneged, contrary to our impressions, what we'd like, the freedom we wish we had to just do whatever we wanted, and things are imposed upon us, we say, hey, yes, that too. That's called, we have a word for that, a very simple word. It's called Yirah Shamayim, right? Yirah Shamayim. Now, in the Nefesh HaChayim, right? Rav Chaim Volozhin, the main student of the Vilna Gaon. Okay, so the Einstein, if Rabbi Akiva is like the Moshe Rabbein of Torah Shebaal Peh, and Einstein is like the Rabbi Akiva of physics, so the Vilna Gaon is like the Einstein of, also he's a Mekubal and a Talmud Chacham, I mean an Ela, knew everything, is like, plays that role also for everyone that comes after. So the Rav Chaim Volozhin is Talmud. And he says something fundamental here, okay? Brings a pasuk. Yirah Shamayim is what's necessary in order to do that work and do it well and create an Ani. It starts with Yirah Shamayim. Reishis Chachma, Yiras Hashem. You can't get to the Chachma to do it right without first having Yiras Hashem. Yiras Hashem means an awareness, okay? That what happened at Har Sinai happened, Klal Yisrael understood that everything is an expression of HaKadosh Baruch Hu and knew viscerally that Hein Hein Lav Lav. Now, we're not there anymore. But our Yirah Shemayim holds us connected to that. And we still know it. Therefore, we have the strength to say today, Lav Hein. You say no? Okay. Then it's no. That's where Yirah Shemayim comes from. It goes back to there. And we need it in order to suppress our own interpretations of things and our own desires and say, fine, to surrender. It's a surrender. Say, then, Alav Hein. Now, Yirah Shemayim is also, he says, and it plays another connected role. He says like this. He says, he brings down the following. He says, the fear of Hashem is his storehouse. Now, what does this mean, that the fear of Hashem is his storehouse? Here, this, he brings this down from Gemara in Shabbos 31a, quotes the verse, the faith of your times will be the strength of your salvations. He brings from Yeshayahu here, the Gemara brings from Yeshayahu, the fear of Hashem is his storehouse. What does it mean that the Yiras Hashem, Yiras Shemayim, is a storehouse? Means like this. A person can compare Torah to a harvest, right? What that means is a person can learn a lot of Torah. Beautiful ideas. There's Torah, and there's Nevi'im, and there's Ksuvim, and there's Mishnah, and there's Talmud, and there's all the ethical works and all the philosophical works. Learn and learn and learn a lot of Torah and harvest. In other words, this is what I own. It's all in my pocket. The problem is that if a person doesn't have a storehouse to put their harvest in, what happens to the harvest? It rots in the field. So, Yeshayahu says that Yirah Shemayim is the storehouse for all the Torah we're learning. If a person learns Torah, and these ideas are so informative, and they're so beautiful, and they're so wise, and we know all the things the Torah demands, and we know about the mitzvahs, and we know the halachos, and we know all of the stories in the Torah, and we know what they're implying, but a person hasn't cultivated the Yirah Shemayim to do that work of choosing what to love and what to make part of their life and what will inform all their choices and what their way of seeing the world will be. If a person hasn't done that work, which is the work of creating the Ani, which comes from Yirah Shemayim, then there's nowhere to put all the Torah. It doesn't actually get stored anywhere. It doesn't actually, it's not there when you go back when you need some food, some nutrition, some provisions. It's not there. It's all rotted. We can't draw on it. In other words, you can know all the Torah we can know. We can learn and learn and learn. But the Yirah Shemayim, which is at the core of the Ani of a person, okay, that helps a person develop an Ani, that must be in place, or everything else doesn't serve us, can't come to our aid. When we come to a point to make a decision, okay, we might know the Torah says no. It's harvested, it's in the field. But there's no Yirah Shemayim. It's not in the storehouse of Yirah Shemayim, so therefore we don't find the strength to act upon that knowledge we have, and that knowledge rots, it stays in the theoretical realm. We don't apply it to our lives. And we don't choose based on it. So, in other words, it's not there for us. It's really not there. All that knowledge is not there for us when we need it to make a decision. It's rotting in the field. So, Yirah Shemayim. Now, we get back to one last point. How do we get the Yirah Shemayim to do that? Remember what we spoke about last week? The ultimate tefillah is the tefillah for Emunah. Remember we said that? Avram Davin for Emunah, that even in a case where Hashem is not explaining to him, like in Sodom, that everything he does is right and just, Avram Davin for the Emunah to know it, despite that we can't explain it, and to trust it, despite the fact that it doesn't look like it's all good and all right, but to trust that Hashem runs the world totally, fairly, Yashar and Emes and Tov. Remember that was Avram's Emunah. And remember Yitzchak's tefillah for Emunah was that Hashem wants us to engage in this world and deal with all the challenges. Emunah, that if Hashem told us to and wants us to, we're capable of it. And we daven to trust ourselves also that we can succeed at this task and not get lost in the process. Remember that? And Yaakov's Emunah was the gullus aspects of history and of a person's life when things are unclear and things are, and we're so to speak, you know, in a place that's very unfamiliar to us, whether it's emotion, you know, whether it's in our real worlds or in our national history, and we're influenced by a lot of things that are contrary to us, in contradiction to us, to know that we can utilize those things for the good. We can actually turn those things into opportunities to learn. We can be stronger because of them. They don't have to kill us and crush us and destroy us. Remember these tefillos for Amunah? And then Klal Yisrael daven for Amunah at the Yam, and we spoke about the idea that it's the Amunah that split the sea, right? It's not like I'm helpless, Hashem, do something for me. I am so completely seeped in an Amunah that I know Hashem exists and all good things that are good are the only things that are expressed in this world. And as clearly as I know that I exist, I'm aware that Hashem exists. So that itself allows Hashem to act through us, we said, and what needs to happen happens in the sea splits. When we say that as clearly as I know I exist, I know HaKadosh Baruch Hu exists, okay? Now we're defining I. Only when a person is engaged, alive, in the work of choosing, does the I exist. And a person knows that they can choose correctly because they've chosen to always to have Yirah Shamayim. What we daven for is we daven for Yirah Shamayim. Now, it's all HaKol B'dei Shamayim Chutz MiYirah Shamayim, right? But we also say that if a person makes a little effort, Hashem compounds their effort, allows them, you know, repays them more. So we do have to put in the first effort. And we're mispalel, we daven, that we should always be, first of all, desire to and increase and never forget and never be distracted from ensuring that we have a Yirah Shamayim, that although we don't see how things are intuitively, obviously, you know, hein, lav, but they did. We have, and we know what they experienced is in our, you know, is in our memory and our psyche, and therefore we trust it. That's called emunah. Emunah is we have confidence and trust that everything is clearly, and everything is an expression of a Kadosh Baruch Hu, the things we do and the things we don't understand. What Hashem says is hein, what Hashem says is lav. We trust that we don't understand it. We're in the mode of Rabbi Akiva. So then we accept that. We daven to have the strength of that emunah and that Yirah Shamayim, because if not for that, there's no one need to be built, and then there's also no use to all the Torah we learn, because it will not come to our aid in the moment that we need it to help us make a decision. So, all of this goes back to the first Rashi, which is Vayidaber Hashem, Vayidaber Elokim es Hadvarim Ela Lemor. Lemor is that Klal Yisrael had a role. Klal Yisrael, Rashi's telling us that when Hashem said this Teseres Adibros, there were two types of acceptances, hein, hein, lav, lav, and hein, hein, lav, hein. That's Klal Yisrael's role. And I just want you to know, if you quickly, Tehillim Kuf Yud Tes, you know that really long one that goes by the Aleph Beis? If you look at the Beis Psukim and the Gimel Psukim, I won't even do it now. Go look at it at home. You'll see. Beis, the Psukim, are about David HaMelech committing to the second system, okay, the Rabbi Kiva system. Being rational, staying committed, only choosing based on what's right, being completely, you know, being steadfast in his attachment to the word of Hashem as his guide. Those are all the bases. And then Gimel, he says, I'll tell you one pasuk, he says, and from that, guess what happens? After approaching Torah like that, now we go backwards. Now, he says, Gal einai v'abita nifla'os mitorasecha. Once a person has rooted that second way into their system, guess what happens? That's the bridge. That's the access point backwards to getting through the mitzvahs themselves, through commitment to the mitzvahs and the actions, accepting them and abiding by them. Guess what happens? A person begins to perceive of things on a much deeper level and sees the first phase comes to the person as in, like a, you might say, a reward or as the natural outcome of a purified mind and a purified heart. So David Melech first talks about what we call the Rabbi Akiva, right? Hein lav hein, and then he says, from that comes Gal Einai, open my eyes and I will see the wonders of the Torah. And Rashi brings down here that this means secret things like the account of creation and other unrevealed to us things. Okay. Two announcements. Next week is the Thursday closest Rosh Chodesh. So if anybody wants to sponsor it for any reason, the brunch, Tanya. Second of all, Rina. here in our class has a chocolate business, and she's making beautiful chocolate shelf munises. Rena, where are you? Right there in the pink. Okay? Everyone have a wonderful week. Thank you.